Okay, we'll start with homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good morning, everybody. Okay, so today we will be taking sutta number 49 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Brahmani Mantika Sutta, Brahmani Mantanika Sutta, which means the invitation by or of a Brahma. So first raise the question, who are the Brahmas? Well, the Brahmas are a certain class of deities or divinities who are supposed to live above the sense sphere heavenly worlds. So within the Buddha's cosmology, we have five realms of existence. There's the hell realms, the realm of afflicted spirits, the animal realm, the human realm. Then there, above the human realm, there are six sense sphere heavenly realms. These are realms of great long lifespan, great happiness, bliss, very exquisite pleasures. And then above the six sense-sphere heavenly realms, there are still higher realms of existence called the Brahma worlds. And then the beings who inhabit those realms are called Brahmas. And so this discourse will be about the Buddha's encounter with one of the beings of that world, whose name is Bhaka the Brahma. It's an interesting question. I don't know how to answer whether this sutta is a, call it a historical account of a dialogue, an encounter that actually took place, or whether it's a kind of, maybe a composition, a literary composition, with certain purposes, maybe call the strategic purposes in mind. Perhaps we can look at it from both points of view. And what seems to be significant is that whenever there is a sutta included within the compilation of texts, even though what takes place on the surface might seem a little bit humorous, trifling, having entertainment value, if we look sort of below the surface, we could usually find some kind of messages being conveyed by the sutta. And so at one level, this discourse has a very powerful, dramatic content, almost like what you might expect from a Hollywood film production. And yet if we look beneath the surface, we can draw out certain messages that are being conveyed. And maybe we could explore to try to find out exactly what those messages are. Okay, so let us go into the sutta itself. So the sutta begins when the Buddha is living in the Anathapindika's monastery at Savatthi, and he's going to relate an incident that took place in the past on one occasion when he was living at a place called Ukkatta in a grove at the foot of a sal tree. Okay, now on that occasion, a certain wrong view of what's called a papaditti, it's a pernicious view, had arisen in one of these Brahmas who's given a proper name. His name is Bhaka. I don't know why he has this name. The word Bhaka in Pali means a heron, or, you know, it's a bird like a stork that lives on, usually lives in the water. How he got that name, I don't know. But the view that arose in him is expressed here in the sutta. This is permanent. This is everlasting. This is eternal. This is total, or maybe we could say this is the ultimate. This is not subject to pass away. For this is where one is neither born, nor ages, nor dies, nor passes away, nor reappears. That means one doesn't take rebirth. And beyond this, there is no other escape, or we could say no higher state of release or liberation. And according to the commentary, this view arose in Bhaka the Brahma, both with regard to the world in which he is living. This is the world over which he is the ruler, the overlord. And also with regard to his own personal identity, and also with regard to the beings who take rebirth into his realm. So he's saying, in effect, that once one is reborn in my realm, then one will live forever and never have to pass away. So if we look at it, then it seems that Bhaka is making a claim that is made in theistic religions for the supreme God. So God says that he is permanent, eternal, everlasting. He says that his heaven is permanent, eternal, and everlasting. And that when one is born into his realm after passing away from earth, then one will live forever and ever, and never have to die again and take rebirth elsewhere. Okay, so what are we to make of this view from a Buddhist perspective? Is the Buddha going to say, nice going? Wise thinking.
No, of course not.
Why not?
Well, hello, someone's getting born. There's the whole problem. There's a rebirth. Once there's a rebirth, it's not ended. There's no nirvana. There's no, you know, blowing out. It's right in there. Reborn,
yeah,
into that realm.
Okay. And how about Israel? Once you get reborn there, can you go on forever?
Well, of course not.
Yeah, okay. And so now the Buddha thinks that he has to dissuade Bhaka the Brahma from this view. So he uses his supernormal power to vanish from the human realm, and he reappears in the Brahma world. And then it's just like when you have a guest coming in the distance. So when Bhaka the Brahma sees the Buddha coming, he says, come, good sir. Welcome, good sir. It's a long time since you found the opportunity to come here. Apparently, it seems, the Buddha had previously visited Bhaka the Brahma. And now this Brahma puts forward his claim. He says, again, this is permanent, everlasting, eternal. This is the ultimate. Here, one doesn't pass away. This doesn't pass away. Here, one is not born, doesn't grow old, doesn't die, doesn't pass away, and so on. And there's nothing beyond this. Okay, so now the Buddha is going to upbraid and admonish Bhaka the Brahma. He says, Bhaka the Brahma, you have fallen into ignorance. You've lapsed into ignorance in that you say of what is impermanent that it's permanent, of what's transient that it's everlasting, of what's not eternal that it's eternal, of what is not the ultimate that it is the ultimate, of what is subject to pass away that it's not subject to pass away. And then the Buddha reinforces the point that here one is born, one grows old, one dies, one passes away, and one takes rebirth elsewhere, even though you're claiming the opposite. And then even though there is some kind of deliverance or liberation beyond this, you say that there is no liberation, no escape beyond this. Okay, so now we have a contest or disagreement of views between the great powerful deity, Bhaka the Brahma, and somebody who appears to be a human being, but who is the fully enlightened one, the Buddha. And so who is going to step in and resolve the, who's going to take the role of the referee or umpire to resolve the disagreement between them? So who takes over that role? And this is interesting. This is Mara, the evil one, takes possession of a member of Brahma's assembly. You see, in this heavenly world, or this divine realm, Brahma is like the overlord, but he is surrounded by a large company of his devotees. These are lesser deities in the same Brahma world. And they follow him, they obey his commands, they praise him. But now Mara is the one who's usually depicted as counterpart of the devil in Buddhism, the one who keeps beings bound to the cycle of rebirths. And yet, this is interesting that in theistic religion, usually the devil or Satan is depicted. Thank you, I didn't go to school, so an educated country. Yeah, so usually Satan is depicted as the opposite, the opponent of God, and the conflict is between Satan and God. But here, Mara takes the side of the Brahma and becomes a kind of advocate for the viewpoint of Brahma. But he does this by sort of taking possession of a member of the assembly, and then he says to the Buddha, he addresses him somewhat impolitely. He just calls him Bhikkhu, Bhikkhu. Don't disparage him. Don't disparage him. Then he sings his praises. For this Brahma is the great Brahma. He's Mahabrahma. He's the overlord, the untranscendent. There's nobody above him. He's the one with the infallible or universal vision. He is the all-powerful, the Lord, maker, and creator, the most high providence, the master, the father, the creator of everything that exists and everything that will ever come to be. So now he's, if you want to join, you can sit down. You can sit on this side if you want. Okay, so first he praises Brahma. And now he's going to spell out some of the painful or miserable consequences that await him if he refuses to acknowledge the supremacy of Brahma. And he does so by trying to induce the Buddha to affirm or to accept the conditioned world, to promote the conditioned world. So he says, before your time, there were ascetics and Brahmins in the world who condemned earth and were disgusted with earth, who condemned water, fire, air, those are the four great elements, who condemned living beings, who condemned the gods, who condemned Prajapati, who condemned Brahma and were disgusted with Brahma. And on the dissolution of the body, the physical body, when their life was cut off, they became established in an inferior body. This means that they were reborn in a lower realm of existence, in one of the realms of misery. So now he's trying, in a sense, indirectly, to threaten the Buddha into siding with Brahma. And now he's going to try to induce the Buddha positively to side with Brahma. He says, before your time, there were also ascetics and Brahmins who praised the earth and delighted in earth, who praised and delighted in fire, in water, fire, and air, who delighted in beings, who delighted in the gods, who delighted in Prajapati, who praised Brahma and delighted in Brahma. And on the dissolution of the body, when their life was cut off, they became established in a superior body. That means they were reborn in a higher realm of existence. Okay, so how would you see the significance of this passage, these two passages? Any ideas or thoughts? Yeah, you have some thoughts.
Yeah, it's sort of a Marxist viewpoint. It just seems like the typical, you know, don't say anything bad against the gods or you'll get it. It's that typical thing that's been used to squash and, you know, inculcate fear in people.
Okay, that could
it's
be.
It's just coming from my particular Weltanschauung this week.
Anybody else have any ideas about this? Neil?
Well, the one thing that strikes me is it seems odd that if he's supposed to be taking the Brahma's side and the Brahma is saying there is no rebirth, that this argument includes, you know, that the good people are reborn.
Well, I think you see the point is that the way I understand it, Bhakta the Brahma's point is that those who, you know, side with him, who venerate him, who accept the idea that he is eternal and everlasting, and probably who worship him and make offerings to him, will get reborn into his realm. I think that's not what he's denying. But his point is that once they get reborn into his realm, then they will be everlasting and they won't fall away and take rebirth elsewhere. But for those who don't acknowledge his supremacy, who don't worship him and make offerings to him, they will get reborn elsewhere. Yeah.
Isn't it also, it's not just the Brahma, but a point of view, the way one sees things, because the Buddha sees things as impermanent and non-existent. And so the argument is really which point of view is correct. right? Am I right? And so it's a philosophical debate.
It is a philosophical debate, yeah. But I'm trying to say, what is the significance of Mara in this disguised form, in a sense telling the Buddha that you shouldn't condemn Earth and be disgusted with Earth, but rather you should appraise Earth, you know, all the elements, all the beings, and delight in beings.
Well, that's because, you know, in Buddhist cosmology, you know, Mara wants to keep everybody sucked in the cycle of the samsara.
Yeah.
That's the Buddhist answer that you're looking for. And he's always, he's not really evil like Beelzebub or Satan.
Exactly,
he doesn't want to torture people or do anything satanic. Yeah. But here, no, wine is good, no, you know, be nice to people. He does a lot if you read these things.
Yeah.
You could be charitable and help people be reborn. He wants everybody sucked.
Yeah.
Yeah,
this is an important distinction between Mara and Satan, that at least in the popular Christian worldview, Satan is in some way connected with hell, and his task is to try to tempt people to break the God's commandments and to deny faith in God, so he'll get them reborn in hell. And then Satan is sort of the overseer of the torture chambers of hell. But in the Buddhist cosmology, Mara has no connection at all with hell and no interest in getting people to go to hell. In fact, Mara is depicted as, in some accounts, as dwelling in one of the heavenly worlds. And he's quite happy for people to get to go to get reborn in the heavenly realm.
And he has three beautiful daughters who he uses to tempt the Buddha as well.
Yeah, well, that comes in one of the stories. So Mara's task is to prevent people from breaking the cycles of birth and death and gaining liberation. But if you go on getting reborn in happy realms, pleasant realms, Mara is content with that. He has no desire to drag beings down to hell. Tracy, did you have something?
I don't know if this offers anything, but Mara's view is very bound up with the body.
Yeah.
And a concern with the fate of the body.
Concerned with what?
With the body.
With the fate of the body.
And it's interesting because I was reading in Jewish theology, evil is which Christianity took up, is that which is outside creation. Mm-hmm. There's something very good about creation.
Mm-hmm.
And Mara here is really advising people to think about their rebirth. In a better body.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's interesting, it's bound up with creation itself.
Mm-hmm.
And the Buddha would say that there's something other, even in creation.
Yeah, I think, basically that's the way I see it too. But Rishid, you had something to say?
Yeah, well, the Buddhist position is close to the Gnostic position, which is that the Gnostics tended to believe that God was totally above this world, that this world was created by a demiurge, and that the purpose of this world was to prevent people from having contact with the real God, who would not ordain simply to create a world like this.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's very similar to the Buddhist position.
Well, I don't know if it's so similar, because Buddhism wouldn't say that this world is a creation of any deity, whether it be a good god or a demiurge, an evil demiurge. It's just that this world exists of itself through causes and conditions.
What I'm saying is similar is that the Gnostics thought that you needed to get beyond this world in order to have it.
I see. Okay. Yeah, I think basically the point that Tracy made is the way I would see this, that according to Brahma's understanding of himself, he is the creator of this world. Like, he is the Lord maker and creator, the master and father of everything that exists. And so Mara is trying to persuade the Buddha to affirm and to applaud and to praise everything that exists as the creative expression of Brahma. Whereas the Buddha sees that everything is impermanent, bound up with suffering and non-self, and so he's become liberated from all the conditioned world.
Baka in Japan, the heron is a symbol of immortality. So baka means heron.
Mm.
Maybe that's the idea that you should.
Perhaps that idea existed in India too. I don't know. I've never encountered it. And also, there's something interesting here in the way Mara, the kind of view that Mara is criticizing, he seems to be misinterpreting the Buddha's attitude towards the conditioned world. Like he says that the ascetics who condemned earth and were disgusted with earth and all the other elements and so forth became established in an inferior realm. So he seems to be thinking that the Buddha also belongs in that category. But the Buddha doesn't condemn the elements and the beings, and his attitude is not that of disgust with them, but rather seeing into the true nature and then becoming detached and liberated from them. But this kind of attitude of condemning the conditioned world and fostering a kind of disgust with them, that was the attitude that prevailed amongst those who followed the extreme type of asceticism that the Buddha rejected. But Mara, it seems, doesn't really understand the Buddha's point of view, and so he thinks that because the Buddha isn't submitting himself to Brahma, that the Buddha belongs to that camp of the extreme ascetics who take this kind of antagonistic attitude towards the created world. Okay, let's go on. So following from that established in a superior body, so Mara is still speaking, and now he's going to give the Buddha a really strong admonition or exhortation. He says, "Be sure, sir, to do only as Brahma says. Never overstep the word of the Brahma." Then if you transgress against the word of the Brahma, then you will meet with calamity, like falling into a deep chasm. Again, never overstep the word of the Brahma. And then he calls on the rest of Brahma's followers as witnesses. He says, "Don't you see the Brahma's assembly seated here?" And he called as witnesses the Brahma's assembly. So probably at this point, all the members of Brahma's assembly applauded the word of Mara and said, "Yes, Buddha, that is the truth." Okay, but now the Buddha isn't fooled by this, by Mara. And so he knows that this being that's been speaking to him is Mara, and now he calls his number. And he says, "I know you, Papima," that means the evil one. "Don't think I don't know you. You are Mara, the evil one." And then this is significant. "And Brahma and the Brahma's assembly and the members of the Brahma's assembly have all fallen into your hands. They've all fallen into your power. You might think that I too have fallen into your power, but I haven't fallen into your hands, O Mara. I haven't fallen into your power." Okay, so this is, again, it's a extremely revealing statement that even though Baka or Brahma is regarded by so many as the supreme deity, the great creator God, but he is, from a Buddhist perspective, he is also almost a puppet in the hands of Mara. He belongs to the realm of finitude, conditionality, the realm of birth and death. And there could also be an underlying, another underlying agenda in this part of the sutta when the Buddha makes that statement. Given the conditions of his time, what could be a kind of underlying, maybe we could call it almost a sociological agenda?
Sidelining Hinduism,
yeah,
he's saying.
Yeah. Actually, what we now call Hinduism didn't really exist in the Buddha's day, but we could say he's sidelining Brahmanism.
And the caste system, maybe? Too?
The caste system? Well, that's not brought up explicitly here. Yeah. But he's definitely he's sidelining the idea of the Brahmins, that Brahma is the deity that they worship, and to experience, to be reborn in the company of Brahma is their great aspiration. And so the Buddha is saying that even Brahma, the supreme deity of the Brahmins, is still within Mara's realm, subject to Mara's control. Could be a good neo-Marxist analysis of the Buddhist text. Okay, again, Bhaka the Brahma reasserts his sort of his creed, his credo, his article of faith, and then he's going to give the Buddha some more warnings. He said, I'm in paragraph 7, about the middle of the paragraph. Before your time, Bhikkhu, there were ascetics and Brahmins in the world whose asceticism lasted as long as their whole life. They knew when there is another escape beyond that there is an escape beyond, and when there is no other escape beyond that there is no other escape beyond. And now Brahma tells the Buddha the truth as it really is, as he sees it. You will find no other escape beyond this. You know, he thinks that the Buddha is still striving and struggling to get to become enlightened to some kind of higher realm beyond his own. But Bhaka is almost becoming dogmatic, categorical here. This is the way it is, and you have to accept it. There's no other higher state of liberation beyond this. Even those ascetics of the past who were far superior to you, tried to find some other state of liberation beyond, and they failed. And so they came to recognize that this is the highest, this is the ultimate. And so now Bhaka, the Brahma, is telling the Buddha, you will find no other escape beyond, and eventually, if you do, if you continue with your ascetic practices, you will reap only weariness and disappointment. It'll just be in exercise and frustration and eventual disappointment. Okay, then Brahma says to Buddha, he says, if you will hold to the earth, if you'll cling to the earth, and delight in the earth, then you will be close to me, like you will come into my company. I will favor you and bestow blessings upon you. You'll be in my domain. So this is a kind of, again, a kind of positive inducement. If you affirm the earth, you worship the earth, you cling to the earth, you seek delight in the earth, then you'll be close to me. I will bestow my blessings and benefits upon you, and we will be like friends. But then he gives also the negatives. This is a little strange. For me to work my will upon and punish, I don't know why he would give that inducement. He would use those words as an inducement. I think he should say that if you don't hold to earth, in that case I will punish you. Doesn't that make better sense? Anyway, he continues in this way. If you will hold to the water, to cling to water, fire, air, beings, gods, Prajapati, to Brahma, you will be close to me in my domain. So that seems like an attempt to induce him. But then he says, for me to work my will upon and punish. Again, it still seems to make better sense to me that if you don't affirm all of these factors, then I'll punish you. Maybe I should just go through some of these terms. So we have the four elements, earth, water, fire, and air. So we could say that these elements, put together, they represent the entire material world. Then we have beings, sentient beings. But since the gods are mentioned separately, we'd have to take sentient beings here to be all of the beings below the level of the gods. Animals, especially animals, human beings, beings in other lower realms of existence. Then we have the gods. Since Brahma imagines himself to be the supreme deity, these would be all of the gods below Brahma. Then Prajapati, a little strange that he's included here. He was one of the old Vedic gods, still mentioned occasionally in the Buddhist texts. Though later he came to be surpassed or superseded by some of the other deities that appeared. And then, of course, Brahma is himself. Okay, then the Buddha says to Brahma, he says, I know this too, Brahma. If I will hold to earth, I shall be close to you within your domain for you to work your will upon and punish. If I will hold to water, fire, air, to beings, gods, Prajapati, to Brahma, I shall be close to you within your domain for you to work your will upon and punish. And so the Buddha affirms that he knows that if he accepts and delights in all of these conditioned things of the world, he will come under the sway of Brahma. And since Brahma is, in a sense, under the sway of Mara, this means that if the Buddha affirms the things of the world, that he will come into Brahma's realm. He will be, since in a way Mara is at one level symbolic of the defilements, especially craving. If the Buddha affirms, delights, and grasps the things of the world, he will become a victim of delusion and craving. But the Buddha now is going to show how he is, how his understanding extends beyond that of Brahma. So he says, I understand your reach and your sway to extend this much, that Bhaka the Brahma has this much power, this much might, this much influence. Okay, so then Brahma asks the Buddha, how far do you understand my reach and my sway to extend? Since Brahma thinks of himself as the almighty deity, he thinks his power and his might extends over the entire universe, all the terrestrial realm, all the celestial realms, even to the highest heaven. He thinks that all of this is under his domination and control. Okay, so then The Buddha says, he replies in verse, he says, as far as moon and sun revolve, shining and lighting up the quarters, over 1,000 such worlds does your sovereignty extend, and there you know the high and low, and those with lust and free from lust, the state that is thus and otherwise, the coming and going of being. Then the Buddha affirms, he again repeats, he says, I understand your reach and your sway to extend thus far, that Bhaka the Brahma has this much power, this much might, and this much influence. Okay, now to understand what's going to come next, it's good to give a little sketch of the Buddhist cosmology. I'll do it in a very general way. Okay, you might have come across the expression about the Buddha's cosmology is sometimes called the triple world or the three realms. So, of the three realms, the lowest realm is the sensphere realm, sometimes called the desire realm. This is the realm of the kama dhatu, the realm in which the dominant motivation is sensual desire. So here we have the hells, the animal realm, the realm of the hungry ghosts or afflicted spirits, the human realm, and then the realm of the gods or the devas. Can you see in the back? the crayon was running low, the pen. Okay, then above the sense sphere realm, we have a large number, about 15 realms which make up, or 15 planes that make up the form realm. And these 15 or 16 planes are divided into four layers. The lowest is the Brahma world, the realm in which the Brahmas exist. Above the Brahma world, there are still higher divine realms. And the second strata, amongst the different deities in that realm, the highest is called, they're called the gods of streaming radiance. Above them is a realm called, is the third strata, and the highest deities in that strata are the gods of refulgent glory. And then the fourth strata, the highest strata in the form realm, in that strata, the highest deities are the gods of great fruit. So we have four main strata making up the form realm. Then above the form realm is the formless realm. That has four planes. We don't have to be concerned with them right now, but you've come across them: the plane of infinite space, plane of infinite consciousness, plane of nothingness, plane of neither perception nor non-perception. Now, the way to each of these, to rebirth into these realms, sort of the decisive factor is karma, that is, our volitional actions. So those who do unwholesome actions, predominantly unwholesome actions, tend to get reborn in the three lower planes of the sense sphere realm. That is, the unwholesome actions will lead to rebirth in the hells, the animal world, or the realm of afflicted spirits. Generally, wholesome actions, wholesome worldly actions, will lead to rebirth in the human realm, or superior wholesome actions to rebirth among the desire realm or sense sphere realm gods. To get reborn in the Brahma world, or to get reborn in the form realm, depends upon mastery over one or another of the four meditations, the four jhanic states. And so those who master the first jhana as their highest attainment tend to be reborn in the Brahma world. Those who master the second jhana will tend to be reborn in the second level, at the highest, the among the gods of streaming radiance. Those who master the third jhana will tend to be reborn in the third strata, the plane of refulgent glory, and those who master the fourth jhana will tend to get reborn amongst the gods of great fruit. So we could say that that far. But to be reborn in the formless realms depends upon mastery over one or another of the four formless meditations. So these meditative states create karma, very powerful karma, very powerful volitional formations in the mind. And then those volitional formations become the, call it the fuel or the propulsive force that leads to rebirth into these specific realms. And so when the Buddha speaks about the sphere over which Brahma exercises sovereignty, he's speaking about Brahma as the sort of the overlord of the thousandfold world system. That's this physical world system in which there are ranged the different sense sphere planes of existence. So Brahma is the lord or master of the beings in these five realms. And of course he is the lord and master of his subordinates in the Brahma world. But according to the Buddha, Brahma doesn't even know about the existence of these higher realms. So the Buddha says, again I'm at the end of paragraph 9, he says, I understand your reach and your sway to extend thus that Bhaka the Brahma has this much power, this much might, this much influence. That is, his might extends over this thousandfold world system where there are supposed to be 1,000 suns, 1,000 moons. And he knows the coming and going of all of the beings in this world system, this thousandfold world system. But now the Buddha will go on to show or to state that there were realms that Brahma does not know, does not see. So he says, Brahma, there are 3 other bodies. It seems a bit strange that the text is using this word body, kaya, but it means like 3 other planes or 3 other realms which you neither know nor see, but which I know and see. There is the body or the realm of the gods of streaming radiance from which you passed away and reappeared here. You have been reborn in this realm after passing away from the realm of streaming radiance. So according to what the Buddha is saying, in his previous life, Brahma had dwelt amongst the gods of streaming radiance. Then when his karma was exhausted, he passed away there and he took rebirth as the chief of the Brahma world. So why doesn't Brahma remember this? The Buddha says, because you have dwelt here for a long time, your memory of that has lapsed, and thus you do not know it or see it, but I know and see it. Therefore, Brahma, in regard to direct knowledge, or abhinya, superior knowledge, I don't stand merely at the same level of you. I'm saying this. I don't stand merely at the same level as you. How then could I know less? Rather, I know more than you. Okay, so now the Buddha is showing that he is aware of the realm of streaming radiance, which Brahma has forgotten. But now the Buddha is going to point out that there are realms even higher than that of streaming radiance. He says there is the body or realm called the gods of refulgent glory. Again, you do not you do not know about it, but I know and see it. Then there is the body or realm called the gods of great fruit. You do not know it or see it, but I know it and see it. Therefore, Brahma, in regard to direct knowledge, I do not stand merely at the same level of you as you. How then could I know less? Rather, I know more than you. What do we make out of this?
Yeah. I'm still formulating.
Anybody have any ideas about this?
I wonder.
Maybe it's good if you take the microphone. We have a.
It's okay. I wonder where does Mara fit into this?
Yeah, interesting question. The question is, where does Mara fit into this? In the old texts, you know, the texts, the suttas themselves, the dwelling place of Mara is not explicitly mentioned. But what the commentaries say, the Pali commentaries, you see in the sense sphere, there are six, there's the realm of the gods. Then there are six realms of sense sphere gods. The highest of them is called the realm. How is it called? The realm of the gods who exercise control over the creation of others. The fifth realm of the Nimana Rati gods, the gods who delight in their own creations. These gods are able to create whatever they want, just through an exercise of will, and then they delight in what they create. But the Paranimitta Vasavati Devas, those are the gods who exercise control over the creation of others. They sort of take over the things that are created by the other gods and control them. I don't really know what that means in actual experience. I sometimes think that that is the realm where movie producers, book editors, literary agents, music producers get reborn. They don't have the creative talents, but they control the creations of others. Okay, and so it's said that Mara lives in the sixth realm, the realm of the gods who control the creation of others, but he lives there like a rebellious prince in a kingdom. You know, he has an argument with his father. The prince wants to get control of the realm. The father won't let him. And so the prince retreats to a remote region within the kingdom together with his rebel forces, and he tries to launch attacks against the king.
It's just like, say, Lucifer rebelled against...
Yeah.
Lucifer rebelled against God.
Actually, that is very, very true.
He was exiled with his lieutenants, his captains.
Yeah, that seems very, I wonder if this idea came... I don't know the Zoroastrianism very much. In fact, I don't know it almost, not at all. But I wonder if that idea could have spread from Persia eastwards to India and affected the thinking of the Pali commentators, and then move from Persia southwest to the Middle East, and then affected Judaic or Christian thinking. Is that in the Old Testament?
In the Old Testament, the Satan was actually, he was known as the accuser. Hmm. It was almost like a job. It was a little bit of a joke. He wasn't in his form as, you know, Beelzebub or, you know, really evil or anything like that. He was more like he was an angel whose job it was to accuse and point out things, and every so often report back to heaven. Mm-hmm. Because if you look at some of the Old Testament, you know, Satan comes into heaven. He actually is allowed into heaven, and God's like, "So where have you been? What have you been doing? Oh, walking the earth. So you were making Job so great." That's
yeah, what I remember Satan.
Yeah, so he had a different. Satan evolved over the years.
Yeah.
As the stories got, you know, mishmashed together.
Any other thoughts on this?
On Satan or the passage?
On this passage, yeah.
This is what it's hard for me to articulate this, but this is, it just reminds me so much of, the Enlightenment. There's the Western Enlightenment where people finally broke free of dependence on gods and really looking at their own selves to, you know, for knowledge and and here's the Buddha really sort of in a proto way doing this. It's a different culture, but it's almost sort of smashing the gods in a sense. Well, that's nice. You're really not so great. And it's almost teaching it. I'm not articulating this well. I'm still formulating this. But it's almost like proto-enlightenment thought. Don't be some superstitious little, you know, git who's running and squirming, you know, towards these gods and let them control you. You are the key in the way. It's up to you.
Yeah, except I would say that there's this, let me just sort of summarize your position for the audience. So Andrea is saying that the Buddha's position here is somewhat like the Enlightenment position, since the thinkers of the European Enlightenment rejected the theistic beliefs of Christianity or claims of Christianity. Some of them were deists who believed that God just created the universe according to certain laws, that it unfolded according to these laws. Others were agnostics. Others were explicitly atheists who denied the existence of any creator God. So she says that the Buddha, in a way, is saying that sort of smashing this belief in the gods and saying that you look within yourself, what is within yourself is important. What I would say is that there is certainly that aspect, but the Buddha is not actually, he's not rejecting the existence of these realms.
But
he's just rejecting the claim that those in these realms, or at least Brahma, make about themselves. So he's sort of exposing the delusions with which they sustain themselves. Neil, that's something.
Well, to take off on that, it also strikes me that what he seems to be saying to this Brahma is, you know, even at the highest level of all these realms, many of which you don't even know about, all of these beings are still subject to karma and still subject to rebirth.
Oh, that's a very good point.
And so,
Let me just summarize that.
I see all this because I'm on the outside of it, because I'm the Lord.
Yeah, okay. What he said is that from the Buddha's perspective, all of these realms, even the realms that are beyond the knowledge, beyond the scope of Brahma's knowledge, are still within the realm of karma and rebirth. Since the Buddha can see how beings pass away from those realms and take rebirth elsewhere.
His audience, though,
Ah, that's a very good point. Yeah, he's
speaking. So he's trying to say, don't be tempted by these other points of view, even though they might be very tempting. And I'm at a higher level than this.
This is a very, very good point. Yeah, something I never thought of.
You know, I'm at a higher level, so don't be sucked into this.
Okay. Yeah, in fact, this is something we almost lose sight of, because the sutta is presented. It starts to take on the form of a dialogue or a trialogue between Buddha, Brahma, and Mara. So we lose sight of the fact that the Buddha is actually speaking to the monks. And so the kind of message that's being conveyed to the monks is that, you know, one shouldn't be sort of attracted, take up these views that these divine or celestial realms are permanent and eternal, and one shouldn't be attracted to the prospect of rebirth in these realms, since existence in these realms is impermanent, and even the sort of sovereign divinities in those realms are inferior in knowledge to myself, since I'm outside the entire conditioned world.
Wouldn't it also lead to suffering if you accepted that point?
Yeah, I think we're going to come to that later in the sutta, but I don't want to sort of jump the gun by getting beyond what we've covered. Tracy?
I'm also, I'm struck by the way he says, I did not claim to be earth, I did not claim to be in earth.
That's sort of getting into the next section.
Bandin, I'm wondering about one thing. If Mara, who has such big wrong view that he is in the deity world, I'm wondering what kind of wrong view the human being has.
I have to say, the position of Mara, it's a little problematic in terms of locating him precisely within this scheme of the universe. And it's just really the commentaries that say that Brahma occupies part of the Deva world. But in the old text, Mara is not placed in any specific realm. So that exactly the nature of Mara, it's a little problematic. There's a certain ambiguity about the nature of Mara. Is he just a symbol for the defilements like craving and ignorance? Or is he truly a separate deity, existing someplace who tempts human beings? And there are passages in the suttas that one could sort of pick out and say, this shows that Mara is really a symbol for the temptations of craving or the delusions due to ignorance. But then there are other passages where Mara tries to attack and mislead the Buddha after his enlightenment. So since the Buddha is enlightened, free of craving and ignorance, then if Mara was just a symbol of craving and ignorance, he couldn't be addressing the Buddha. But then the fact that we have suttas like that doesn't mean that these were actual historical events. They can be partly metaphorical, partly literary creations in order to, again, convey a particular point. Because when Mara challenges the Buddha, again, he's usually taking one of the standpoints that things are permanent, so delight in them. Things can give you true enjoyment, so enjoy them. Things are yourself, so identify with them. And then the Buddha always addresses Mara by saying, no, that's not permanent, that's impermanent. No, that's not blissful, but really suffering. No, this is not self, but non-self. So the dramatic dialogue gives an opportunity to assert the Buddha's point of view in a rather way that, has a certain aesthetic and literary appeal to it. If you just get sermons, form is impermanent, suffering is impermanent, form is impermanent, feeling is impermanent, perceptions, mental activities, consciousness is impermanent. It gets a little tedious. But if you have a dialogue where somebody is trying to appeal to the Buddha, convince him, it's permanent, it's pleasurable itself. Then the Buddha responds, no, it's impermanent. Dukkha, unsatisfactory, non-self. It becomes, exciting. Like a good TV drama.
Andrew, I have a question. Was Brahma really telling what he believed, or he's lying?
It seemed from the sutta that he's saying what he believes. What makes you think that he's lying?
He has, at least to some extent, he is concerned Buddha is correct, so he lost his grip. So to a certain extent, he is concerned that Dharma is true.
I think he's definitely concerned about that, maybe worried about that. But I think at this point, he hasn't yet acknowledged that the Buddha is right. That will come a little bit later in the sutta. The way I see it. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But that's the way I see it. Anybody else have any ideas? Okay, let me see what some of the questions have come through the internet. Okay. See, This is question one. It seems to me that the Buddha often does take on this attitude of disgust to the world. For example, there is the meditation on what's called the foulness of the body. There's also the teaching on cultivating what's called the sense of disgust towards samsara. Is this view legitimate? Actually, there is a certain point in that. But what I would say is that this is the kinds of strategies that the Buddha uses in order to overcome. The purpose is not to generate the disgust itself, but say in regard to the contemplation of the body, the parts of the body, the purpose is to overcome sensual craving or sensual lust by seeing the body as it is. And in regard to, I don't think we use the term the sense of disgust towards samsara, but it's called anabhiratta, sabaloke anabhiratta, which means the sense of non-delight in all the world. Again, it's your purpose is to turn the mind away from delighting in the things of the world in order to seek nibbana or liberation. Okay, in relation to question one, please ask Bhante about the Pali words nibbida and viraga. Do they both mean dispassion? Okay, first the words that are used in the sutta for disgust. The word that's used for disgust is called jigucha, which is not a word that the Buddha uses in his own teaching in relation to his own practice. Jigucha is, yeah, it corresponds closely to the English word disgust. And this was a kind of practice that was taken up by the ascetics of his time to develop this disgust towards the body and towards things of the world. But the Buddha uses the two words nibbida and viraga. Nibbida comes, if you take it etymologically, it means finding out, like finding out the truth of things. But the way it functions, I translate it as disenchantment. It means that when you find the true nature of things, that all of these phenomena are impermanent, connected with suffering and non-self, then one becomes disenchanted with them and is ready to turn away from them to seek liberation. And then viraga is the word that could be translated as dispassion. Literally, it means the fading away of a bright color. So it's the mind saturated with lust is like a mind brightened by a color, and then viraga is the fading out of that bright color. So that comes to mean dispassion. A question. Okay, somebody says, to really break the dogmatic creator God beliefs and seek higher knowledge, it seems that direct experience of the four jhanas and the higher states through meditation practice is mandatory. I mean, I don't want to get into a discussion about that point now. Okay. Is the Tathagata Garbha and the Buddha nature concept predominant in Mahayana Buddhism the same as the Brahman's Mahabrahma idea in disguise? They sound a lot like what the Brahma proclaims. I don't see such a close connection between the Tathagata Garbha and what Mahabrahma is claiming here. Mahabrahma is claiming to be an individual being who is permanent and everlasting, and he's claiming that his world is permanent and everlasting. Though there do seem to be some connections or similarities between what is called Tathagata Garbha, or this is sometimes called Buddha nature, and the Atman or Brahman of Vedantic philosophy. But there are also subtle differences between them. But again, to go into the details, it's beyond my capability here. Okay, we'll end here, and then we'll take the rest of the sutta next time. We'll have the class next week. I'll have to make up the schedule for the coming months and send it out. I'll try to do that tomorrow. Okay, let us end with the sharing of the merits. Akasata chibumata deva naga mahidika punyanta anumodiva shiram rakantu sasanam. Akasata chibumata deva naga mahidika punyanta anumodiva shiram rakantu desanam. Akasata chibumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyanta Namamoditva Shiram Rakantu Mamparam Eta Vatacha Mehi Sampadam Punya Sampadam Do it the short way Sabe Devanumodantu Sabasampati Siddhya Sabe Bhutanumodantu Sabasampati Siddhya Sabe Satanumodantu Sabasampati Siddhya Bhava Gupadaya Vichihetato Etantare Satakayu Bapanna Rupiya Rupicha Sanya Sanino Dukha Pamuchantu Pusantu Nibotin.